The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Hi, everyone. I'm excited to see so many people in the room. I'm sad to tell you that I have the depressing part of the talk, where I like lay out the history of where Right to Work came from, and it's not a very sunny one, so bear with me. I'm going to try and make three main points. The first one is what I just said, the racist roots of Right to Work legislation, which I do think is incredibly important for us to understand and helps point the way forward. The second, more brief, just to remind ourselves as Marxists how we view the role of trade unions in class struggle. And then the third point, which maybe will spark some discussion, is that I actually want to argue that Right to Work legislation all by itself is not a death blow to the union movement. Instead, it's a serious threat right now because it represents an extreme advance of the conservative right, which is frightening. And number two, it's a threat because of the precarious state of our unions today. Okay, so the first point, where did Right to Work come from? I want to start with a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King in 1961. He says, quote, "In our glorious fight for civil rights, we must guard against being fooled by false slogans such as right to work. It is a law to rob us of our civil rights and job rights. Its purpose is to destroy labor unions and the freedom of collective bargaining by which unions have improved wages and working conditions of everyone. Wherever these laws have been passed, wages are lower, job opportunities are fewer, and there are no civil rights." So in 1961, Right to Work was a threat just as it is today. And civil rights leaders like Dr. Martin Luther King really recognized it for what it was, an attempt to divide and weaken the working class, lower wages, and lower the general standard of living for everyone. So you can probably guess, but Right to Work originated in the South. It was a brainchild of a fairly disgusting human being named Vance Muse. He was an anti-Semitic, anti-communist, anti-union racist from Texas, and he had two big ideas. One, that whites should not be, quote, forced into unions with black workers, and two, he believed, I think we would agree, that blacks and whites organized together into unions could potentially upend the order of the Jim Crow South. So he was a Texas businessman, and like I said, he viewed union organizing as a real threat to white supremacist segregationist order. A quote from him that really makes this clear, quote, "From now on, white women and white men will be forced into organizations with black African expletive whom they will have to call brother or lose their jobs." So publicly, he really framed this as an issue of race. In 1936, he formed an organization called the Christian American Association, and he formed it initially to organize against FDR's re-election. The organization had close links to the KKK, and they had close links to a group called the American Legion, which was a right-wing veterans organization that on the regular violently terrorized minorities and violently busted up unions. So it was this organization, the Christian American Association, with Muse's direction, that mobilized under the slogan, quote, "Right to Work." So it's important to note that Muse wasn't only a bigot, he was also an oil industry businessman. His Christian American Association was backed by Southern oil companies and by industrialists from the Northeast. It was not only racism that drove their vicious attacks against union organizing. It was a clear understanding that a unified working class, black and white workers together, was the largest possible threat to business interest and profitability. So as people in this room probably know, the 1930s saw massive union growth in the North. And the CIO and the AFL were now charging southward with what was called Operation Dixie. So in the 1930s in Texas, only 10% of workers were in unions. By the next decade, through the operations of the CIO and the AFL, that number had increased by 225%. That's astounding, from 10% to 225%. It's important to note that it's not just that unions were expanding bargaining power and therefore improving wages and working conditions of working class Texans, it was also that they constituted a clear political threat. The CIO in particular opposed Jim Crow and had demanded an end to segregation. So for Muse and the Christian American Association, the enemy was very clear. Unions must be taken down. They began not by lobbying for right to work, but instead by attempting to pass what they called an anti-violence bill that made public union pickets illegal. And they argued this on the premise that it would disrupt wartime production. This, even though most of the production in Texas had nothing to do with the wartime effort. But this did pass in Texas, and then bills like this spread rapidly in other states and took away an important, obvious tool for workers. So after that success, Muse and his organization spread to fight right to work. So I want to pause quickly from my story of Vance Muse, just to lay out what the term right to work actually means, because we're using it a lot in the last couple of years, and it's not totally obvious. So right to work as it began was a direct response to union rights that were won during the 1930s from labor battles, and those rights were put into law in the Wagner Act, or sometimes called the National Labor Relations Act, in 1935. So this act was really important, and it did a lot of things. It formalized union relationships and made it illegal for employers to refuse to bargain with unions. And in addition, it laid out the different possibilities of the type of union shops that could exist. The two that are relevant for our conversation are a closed shop and an agency shop. So a closed shop is a workplace where, in order to work there and be an employee, you just have to be a member of the union, no questions. An agency shop is a little bit different. You don't have to be a member of the union. You have a choice about joining the union, but even if you're not a member of the union, you have to pay what's called an agency fee, which the union argues helps them to cover the cost of collective bargaining, which everyone in the union, everyone in the workplace, regardless of union membership, benefits from. So for Vance Muse and the people that he represents, when they say right to work refers to the right to work without being required to pay dues or an agency fee. So for the conservative right during the late 30s and 40s, this was a clear means to wage a direct blow at unions' monetary foundation and their security, which they had only very recently won. So going back to Vance Muse, along with a cohort of business interest groups, they managed to pass the right to work bill. They expanded well beyond Texas, and by 1947 had passed the bill in 14 different states. This is a very volatile time. In 1947, the federal government also passed the Taft-Hartley Act, which dealt a very decisive blow to labor, and I don't have time to go into all the details of that. But among a lot of other debilitating measures for labor, it enshrined what a lot of these southern states had already done into law, saying it's legal. Part of the law is that states can opt to pass a right to work legislation, which abolishes both closed shops and agency shops. And that's what we're facing today. So since then, since 1947, when 14 states already did this, the right has slowly chipped away, one state at a time, to the point where we are today, which is that 28 states, including Midwestern union strongholds like Wisconsin and Michigan, are on the list, which is both heartbreaking and, like, I don't even know what adjective to use to describe it. So those are legislative attacks that have run state by state. In addition to legislative attacks state by state, more recently, the right has also made use of the Supreme Court as a means to challenge union rights. So people probably followed last year the Friedrichs case, where public sector unions face a potential blanket ruling that would make collection of agency fees specifically for public sector unions against the law. So in the Friedrichs case came up last spring, labor braced itself for what was inevitably going to be a verdict in favor of the plaintiffs, and then Justice Scalia died, and there was a tied vote. And we got a short reprieve. But the reality is that that case is dead, and there's currently another one in the works. And if that one doesn't go the way that they hope, there's another one behind that. So the one right now that's coming up in the Supreme Court is Janus versus AFSCME. Different union, different employer, based on the totally same premise. So the premise on which these cases are based is that all public sector union activity is political activity. The Friedrichs case was actually brought by, I think, 9, maybe 10 teachers in California that simply said that they shouldn't be compelled to pay any kind of fee, dues, or agency fees to a union that takes positions that they disagree with. So some of the things that they raise that they disagree with are tenure. They disagree with the fact that the union advocates for more money to go towards public education rather than public safety. They disagree with the union advocating for higher salaries for teachers in the time of economic crisis. They disagree with the union's anti-school voucher positions. So as a result of the fact that they politically disagree with the positions that their union is taking, making them pay agency fees is the equivalent to coercing them into political speech that they disagree with, and it's therefore against the law. So a ruling in favor of the plaintiffs would mean that collection of agency fees by public sector unions nationwide is against the law and would have to stop. So just to make that clear, for example, I live in New York City. I am a part of a public sector union in New York State. We are not a right-to-work state, but if and when a verdict like this passes, my union will no longer be able to collect agency fees. And also just to say that based on the recent Citizens United case that ruled that political spending is a form of protected political speech, so like corporations are allowed to give money because that's a form of their political speech, there's absolutely a legal precedent for the conservative court to rule in favor of the plaintiffs in these cases. So things don't look great in that respect. So just to go back to the forces behind who's pushing this. The forces behind the right to work bills all the way back to Vance Mews, and now court challenges like Friedrichs and Janus haven't really changed that much. While backers of the bills and the court cases often hide behind the premise of being pro-worker by nature and of representing like workers' rights to choose, and they often do have a handful of token workers on board, the movement is led without a doubt by big business, the likes of the Koch brothers. And I don't have time to go into it, but it was fascinating to read the direct lineage between Vance Mews and then the Koch brothers' father and then the Koch brothers themselves. It's like right there. But I want to look, for example, at the Friedrichs case. So as I said, the plaintiffs were teachers alongside the Christian Educators Association International. But what's important is that the case was prosecuted by an organization called the Center for Individual Rights. And if you're curious, Google it. You'll find out some interesting stuff. So it's a right-wing pro bono law group. But then this organization is directly connected to a whole bunch of other organizations. They have a very clear history of fighting things like affirmative action, supporting legal cases that challenge the Right to Vote Act, and lots of union busting. So they have really direct ties to the Koch brothers and to the organization of the Koch brothers called Americans for Prosperity. People may have heard of them before. That group donates heavily to the Center for Individual Rights. So a quote by Americans for Prosperity lays out a little bit of the political thinking of why they have their sights so clearly set on destroying public sector unions. He's talking about why Republicans weren't able to gain as many seats as they wanted in the 1990s in Congress. And he says, quote, they had the public employee unions. He's talking about the Democrats, which have only gotten stronger, have only gotten better funded, have only gotten better organized in the period of time between the 1990s and today. So it's clear that public sector unions represent a stronghold of the Democratic Party, and they want to attack that. In addition, their broader agenda is fairly straightforward. Destroy public sector unions that unify the working class, disenfranchise and further marginalize immigrants, black and brown people, continue to sow racist divisions in the class, and then reap the benefits sown for business. You can look quickly and find that the statistics of living in a right-to-work state really show that their strategy is quite effective. There are a lot of benefits for big business of instituting right-to-work right-to-work laws. Wages in right-to-work states are 3.5% lower than in right-to-work states. The rate of employee-sponsored health insurance is 2.5% lower. The rate of employee-sponsored pensions is 5% lower. And there's lots of other ways to illustrate the fact that living class standards in right-to-work states are way worse off that I don't have time to go into. So why is it worth digging into this tangled web of who's who and who's behind these threats? I would argue that it's important because understanding what's driving the right-to-work attacks really illustrates why it's such a threat. Removing the ability, as I said before, to collect agency fees all by itself wouldn't be a death blow to unions in the United States. The reality is that we have lots of evidence of decades of union organizing where unions didn't have the right to collect agency fees and they thrived. That's not to say that we want to get rid of it. They're a good thing, we want them, but that all by itself wouldn't put us in the situation that we're in today. It's a real threat because of what it represents, a frightening advance of the agenda that I've described above. It's part of a coordinated attack on the basic living standards of working class people. The right understands that unions, particularly public sector unions today, are the primary bodies of defense for the working class. And as it stands right now, their side is winning. Sorry. So this brings me to my final point. In addition to the fact that these attacks represent a larger, terrifying agenda that's marching forward, right to work is a serious threat because of what our unions have become. And this is where I think it's helpful to step out for a second and look at the role of unions as Marxists understand them. So we understand unions as the front line of defense for the working class. We understand that they're a crucial component in the self-activity of the class, but we also understand that they are not revolutionary organizations. And we understand that they're actually part of a capitalist system, and their very function within that system is to negotiate the terms of workers' exploitation under capitalism. So there's nothing inevitable about the way that they operate. They can be militant. They can be bottom-up fighting organs for the class, and they certainly have. But they can also be top-down, tied to the Democratic Party, and more interested in maintaining order than making real gains for workers. And unfortunately, today, the majority of our unions fall into the latter category. So public sector unions, following on the heels of private sector, have fallen into top-down bureaucratic organizations that basically provide services in the form of healthcare and non-political grievance procedures. And most of us would argue they don't do that very well. Union leaderships have tied their own futures and the futures of the unions that they lead to the Democratic Party. This is the Democrats who have shown time and time again that they don't really give a shit about what happens to labor other than labor's ability to turn out votes during elections. So because union bureaucracies are so set apart from their membership, they don't actually experience the givebacks or the contracts that they negotiate. They occupy a very unique material position, and they simply have different interests than the workers that they represent. So what motivates them is maintaining their own position and holding on to their seat at the big bargaining table. They see concessionary bargaining, usually behind closed doors, and political lobbying as the best and really the only way to do both things, to maintain the union's position as a player at the table and to keep blatant exploitation at bay. And that's in their view. I think we would argue that we come pretty close to blatant exploitation on the daily. So it's this context that makes right to work a real threat. The past decade has seen the lowest numbers of work stoppages on record. The average number of major work stoppages by decade has declined over 95% since 1947. The rank and file of most unions is actively demobilized. Union bureaucracies view militant activity as a threat to the status quo rather than as our most effective tool, and they actually organize against mobilization. So we've seen over and over again that the strategy of waiting on Democrats to be the savior of labor is bankrupt, but sadly it still dominates. This means that labor is left without effective tools to counter the blow of right to work. What we've seen over the last few years is that unions that have a more militant stance, even in right-to-work states, have not seen their membership decline in the way that more top-down unions have. So while the landscape of labor is quite dismal, there are bright spots that point the way forward that Joe and Lily, thank God, will talk about. And where we go from here truly does depend on the balance of class forces, which makes on-the-ground shop floor organization for our side urgent. The gains of labor over the last century have not come from bureaucratic deal-making. They've come from hard-fought battles on the shop floor, on picket lines, and in the streets. Literal battles. The history of labor struggle in this country is vibrant, it's gritty, it's strong, sometimes it's violent. And every victory was won by workers, by rank and file, struggling together, sometimes with union leadership, but often by pushing beyond it. Looking at the origins of right to work and the organizations still behind the attacks today show the way in which the conservative right understands the threat of unions as organizations that bring together white and black workers. They make clear through their actions that busting unions and dividing the class along race lines, immigrant lines, gender lines go hand in hand as tools of exploitation. Our side has to understand that connection as well. Building strong, powerful unions that can win and taking up struggles against racism or against anti-immigrant bigotry or Islamophobia are not separate and must be integrated in central parts of rebuilding a fighting left. Our side's power lies in our ability to threaten disruption on a massive scale, the ability to shut down schools, trains, hospitals, profit-making in general, and business as usual at our will. Without that, the future does look grim. But with the resurgence of rank and file militarism, shop floor organizing, and unionism that extends beyond the workplace into communities, politicizing our struggles as a fight for the entire working class, there is a chance for some hope. And Joe and Lily will tell us about it.
All right, thanks, folks. So I just want to give a basic overview of how unions have kind of found themselves in the current crisis, what they've done or have not done to prepare for the oncoming threat, and some possible ideas about how unions can tomorrow start to move in the right direction and not only survive, but maybe even grow after a right-to-work regime. This is a packed room. I'm really excited to hear what people say in the discussion, and so I'd love it if union activists would chime in and people could report out on what's going on, and we could have a great discussion. So I'll try to keep it fairly short. So what the Janus versus AFSCME case would do, just quickly, would overturn a Supreme Court decision called Abood versus the Detroit Board of Education. It was a Supreme Court ruling in the mid-1970s that enabled unions to collect representation or agency fee from non-members. And it's important to point out that the Abood decision came after really 15 or nearly even 20 years of militant, what were usually illegal public sector strikes. It started largely in New York City, although Wisconsin was the first state to allow public sector collective bargaining. It's the strike wave started in New York City with a strike that established the United Federation of Teachers and spread to K-12 school districts all across the United States. You know, other public employees and the sort of state government agencies all over the country participated in public sector hospitals. You name it, really. I mean, it was a part of the 1960s and 70s upsurge that expressed itself at the level of the workplace. And, public sector unions before the 1960s were essentially a kind of small assortment of public employee professional societies or even sometimes even study circles that were connected with left-wing organizations and whatnot. So the socialist movement has a deep connection to public sector unions dating back into the era of the Great Depression and even before. AFT Local 1, the Chicago Teachers Union, was founded here in Chicago by an Irish socialist school teacher. You know, there's deep connections there that we can talk about. But they were very, very much a minority sort of force across the country. And within the span of a decade or two, swept up hundreds of thousands and then eventually millions of people into the ranks of the public sector union movement. And that's a pretty incredible accomplishment in the span of 15 to 25 years. There was a time when teacher strikes happened at the beginning of the school year, and they were about as predictable as the changing colors of the autumn leaves in the fall. And unions like District Council 37 of AFSCME in New York City, where I live, used to shut down vital city services in order to demand and really win major contract gains. There was a famous Uniform sanitation men strike in New York City, where in the middle of a heat wave in July, the garbage men stopped collecting trash in New York City, which is about the most threatening, you know, damning, horrific kind of punishment you can impose on a city, on a helpless city. Other times, they would even the bridge operators and all the East River bridges would actually turn them, and they'd throw the keys in the East River and say, try to do this without us, whatever. So just, you know, jam up traffic across the entire tri-state area. I mean, these things used to happen. This is not the sort of storied lore of the Great Depression when the brawny heroic workers, you know, fought it out, whatever. This is stuff that my parents' generation lived through and participated in. And many of the people in the room would have recognized some of these things. So the Abood decision then comes about as a specific trade-off for labor peace through regularized and stable collective bargaining in exchange for the collection of agency fees, union protection, and top-down bureaucratic collective bargaining done between sort of elite negotiators on the behalf of the union and management to try and keep the sort of rowdy rank and file out of the room. This was a trade-off that happened some time ago, and that it really represents the way that labor was hoisted by its own petard, you could say, because of the damning impact that had on labor's ability to organize and fight back. So the labor movement, I would say, lost its way and let its organizational muscles stagnate by retreating from militancy in the streets, by setting itself up as an ATM for the Democratic Party, and that you can see how that relationship played out across the country in different places. I use the example of a used tea bag that has been passed from one cup of lukewarm water to the next, and to represent how one generation after another of union leaders have eventually lost any vision or ability at all to organize and wield class power. And it's pretty striking. You think about the generation of people who set up these public sector unions in the 1960s and were able to wage, you know, illegal public sector strikes all over the place. Nowadays, to compare, they're sort of a shadow of their former selves, right? That tea bag that's gone from one cup to the next. And because of that, over the last several generations, we're at a very, very different moment in time. The legal framework for public sector collective bargaining is going to change. If you're in a public sector union, don't fool yourself. Don't listen to the people, don't listen to the false prophets who are out there saying that maybe we'll survive and dodge another bullet. It is going to happen, folks. It is going to happen. And in the next 8 to 15 months, your union is going to lose the ability to collect agency fees from non-members. Like, get it through your head right now. It's going to happen, okay? So, I want that to inform the basis of our discussion moving forward so that we can have some clarity about this, because you would actually be shocked at how delusional a lot of people are in the public sector labor movement about how, you know, maybe things will just work out for the best, and, you know, maybe the best of all possible worlds would happen, you know. It's worth saying that 27 or 28 states already are right-to-work states where, because of relatively recent legal and legislative attacks during the Obama administration in Wisconsin, Indiana, Michigan, and other states as well, you know, a majority of states do not allow the collection of agency fees. So that situation just can't hold forever where some states can do it. Because the problem with this, of course, is because of the labor law framework of the United States, unions are still legally mandated to represent anyone in the units and the workplaces that they represent, even if they don't pay any kind of fee, right? There's a mandatory command that people have to represent people who are even could be union-hating scabs. If they have a problem, unions have to represent them. So this famously sets up the free rider problem, right? And the theory goes that, in effect, this would limits union effectiveness and new organizing capabilities by restricting dues income, and that, you know, leads them to make more conservative decisions. And that certainly has been the case in state after state where it's happened. So I want to give a brief overview of the different strategies that unions have embarked upon in anticipation of this legal change, and some of them are better than others. It's worth noting that in most national unions, no one actually launched a conversation about how to change the power dynamics at unionized workplaces, the relationship between the rank and file and the sort of entrenched bureaucracies which govern most U.S. unions. So some people in the room might smirk at this because of, you know, internal conversations in a certain international union where for a time there was a strategy that was put forward as plausible where they could just robocall non-members across the United States and people could press 9 if they wanted to join their union, which is about the least least about the least effective thing you could do. My own union actually robocalls me, and I'm a Revolutionary Socialist Union organizer, and I still don't answer the phone. It drives me. I'm like, oh God, it's my union with the robocalls again. Click. So I'm glad that one got put to bed, because that's just not going to go anywhere. There was even talk for a time, and this won't surprise anyone, there was talk for a time of coming to a private settlement with Mr. Janus, and you can read in between the lines about what that exactly means, to get the person to withdraw their case already in front of the Supreme Court, which, you know, at best, even if they could buy the guy off, whatever, is still going to, you know, save people for, what, another 12 or 15 months? You're talking about shooting yourself in the foot. And then, of course, there's people who are basically coming up with the assumption that they can just rely on Democrats and state legislatures to enact statewide exceptions to the Supreme Court ruling. So there's a man named Michael Mulgrew, and I'm sure people in the room can talk about what his record is. But he, you know, at a speech in front of the UFT delegate assembly some time ago, he basically said that right to work was a certainty, and through his inactivity, he actually made that true. Right to work is a certainty, and you know, other people like him. And so we'll basically figure out our response when it actually happens. Like, we're not going to do anything right now, but when it does, you know, we'll basically cross that bridge when we come to it. And it's like, oh, that's brilliant. There was also a labor lawyer who I'm not going to name, and a liberal pundit who wrote an article in These Times, in the magazine In These Times, a couple of months ago, and he literally wrote this. He said, labor should not fall into the trap of fighting a national right to work act head on. He's referring specifically in the private sector, but I think the same applies. By launching a national right to work fight and defending the fighting against right to work, the union movement might drive moderate Republicans into the arms of their own party's right wing, and instead we should just do nothing and just wait this one out, because, you know, maybe Trump won't come after us. So it's really not looking good for most unions. I hate to say this, and I'm sure people will report out on their own sort of worst nightmare stories that's going on. Some unions actually have begun preparations for the Friedrichs case when it was coming a year ago, before God granted us an enormous favor in taking Scalia. So some people have been preparing for a while, and those unions are actually in much better shape, I think, and ready to prepare. But, you know, for the most part, there's just been a lot of bad ideas. I want to take a minute to make a specific point, because this drives me crazy, and I used to live in Wisconsin and worked in the labor movement in Wisconsin. People routinely compare a right-to-work bill as equivalent to what happened to the public sector labor movement in the state of Wisconsin, and I want people to specifically and emphatically say that is not true, and to come to clarity on this. So there's a big difference between Act 10, which Scott Walker signed into law in 2011 in Wisconsin, and what Right to Work does. And that's 10 minutes have transpired.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. So the restriction, what Act 10 in Wisconsin did was specifically restrict all legal collective bargaining in the public sector to the issue of wages alone, and only unions can only win increases in wages up to increases in the consumer price index. So it legally restricts the scope of public sector collective bargaining down to the most minimal sort of tiny little field. It also allows for management to just eventually impose their final offer. So that's some meaningful negotiations there. It eliminates dues checkoff entirely from paychecks by employers. So unions must now only collect dues by credit or debit card deductions or automatic bank drafts. And it also mandates annual recertification. So a union must vote every year to recertify and have an absolute majority of the entire bargaining unit vote, not just a majority of eligible voters, in order to be recertified. This is not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is the financial loss of agency fee collection from non-members. So this is an important distinction. And what that means is that the most likely impact is that unions will lose 10% to 30% of their membership, and, you know, that sort of commensurate amount of dues income when this comes through. Some unions will do fine, and many others maybe will take even more of a beating, but what that we're talking about now is a pretty significant loss of membership and financial resources. That's different, though, and we should be also clear about this. This is not going to create a union-free or a post-union environment. And I want to specifically argue against a sort of Chicken Little type panic that has encompassed a lot of people, who basically said, the argument is that, well, if we can't collect agency fees from non-members, we can't survive. We just can't survive, and we should just basically pack up and go home, and you should just start lowering your expectations right now, because if we did very little for you now, we're going to do even less for you tomorrow, basically, and we should totally reject that. That is not necessary. That's not guaranteed things can go a different way. But you know, it's very very likely that most or many union leaders are going to double down on the failed strategies of the past, or simply restrict what they offer in terms of representation or services in order to economize their costs. I think it could also lead to mergers and acquisitions between unions, and there's talks happening right now between two major national unions about merging together in order to create economies of scale in their staffing operations. And it'll mean a lot of unions are going to double down on political spending, and they're going to support terrible, terrible people who can't even be bothered to even vocally support unions. This is the case in New Jersey, where I work. I'm sure people can relate to that here in the state of Illinois. I think people can think of that in New York and all over in the West Coast, all over the place. You know, this is really a case of like people who, from as the prophet Jeremiah said in the Old Testament, have eyes but do not see, and have ears and do not hear. So I think in order to respond to this, I'm just going to wrap up pretty quickly. I think people just have to go back to what I like to refer to as that old-timey religion and get a good dose of that. So I think the revolutionary socialist left has been foretelling the destruction of or the coming attacks for a long, long time, and warning people to kind of return to the faith. And I think that we should talk in those terms and say this is a real threat. It is not a drill. This is really going to happen. But we should also be level-headed and clear about what the actual threat is and what we can actually start to do now, not robocalling. How do we actually take steps tomorrow to defend our unions, make sure that they survive, and then also go on the offensive even, you know, ideally. So I think there's three things really quickly. So I think the first thing that unions have to do is go back to the shop floor. It's been a dynamic within the American public sector union movement for a long time, and in the private sector as well. The unions are basically a representation agency that, you know, call us when you have a problem, like a kind of an insurance company or an insurance policy, but we're not really going to fight problems in the workplace. You just kind of do your thing, good luck out there, and you know, give us a call at our call center or 1-800 number or whatever, and we'll come represent you when you have a problem. Unions actually have to contest power on the shop floor, because if all you do is represent workers and negotiate, you know, shitty contracts with management, or then eventually have really terrible contracts with management because you don't even have a majority of your members signed up. Members are not going to pay union dues for a union that just gives away the farm anyhow. They can have management screw them for free. So why pay union dues, right? So that's the first thing. And in order to organize that workplace resistance, the public sector union movement has to recruit and train a steward's army that will act as the backbone and the sort of organizing force in workplaces all across this country. I know people have stories about their own shop stewards, some good, some bad, but this is really the sort of militant minority or the cadre later. It can be that sort of layer within the union movement that actually organizes this resistance, turns workplace grievances into fights, and really sort of marshals our side to take up those battles. And I think number three is that we absolutely have to take up class-wide demands and demands that would improve the condition of the entire working class and make labor a champion of the poor and the downtrodden in ways that would really benefit, you know, millions of people beyond the ranks of the union movement, and maybe would actually inspire people to join the union and continue to pay dues. So I think what that looks like is you know, issues like fighting for single-payer health insurance, defending the undocumented, siding with the Black Lives Matter movement, playing an active role in all those sort of social questions that come up all the time. Maybe fighting for pensions for people, regardless of whether they're union members or not. Like, how about that? You know, there's a tradition in this country of unions doing those things. Not a majority tradition, but it's something that can be fought for and expanded. And you know, there's instances in the past where unions were able to do this. The CIO was built through winning the allegiance of thousands and then hundreds of thousands of union members and workplace activists through policing the shop floor and fighting back against management prerogative and foremen. When people didn't want to pay their dues, they would throw up a dues picket line in front of a factory and say, "You damn sure better." And you know, some of this is we're gonna have to return to that. And there's instances I can think of where, you know, like local 226 of the hospitality workers in Nevada, which is a right to work state, they have 96% union membership. There's a Teamsters local at a shipyard in Indiana right down the road that has basically 100% membership through doing these sort of practices. The postal workers in Boston, they have a 94% membership rate. Like this is possible. possible. These things are real. This is not fantasy, but we actually have to start working on this right now and move things forward. Thanks.
Okay, so I'm picking up where Joe left off, and I'm going to talk about sort of an analysis of the political relevance and organizing strategy of some union work. And what I would like to do in this part of the talk is set up some points for discussion about labor strategy and how certain sectors of the labor movement contribute to rebuilding the left in different ways. I think that, along with Joe and I think Emily, I think a realistic view is that there are a lot of opportunities, including some of the most exciting labor fights that have gone on in my lifetime. And we're also facing this attack because of the weakness of the left and the destruction of working class institutions as a whole. And it's interesting to read. I think it's important to have that sort of sober perspective that we're arguing for, because I was reading some articles about like Fight for 15 in 2012 and these predictions of this big upheaval. And so we need to take stock of what strategies worked and didn't work, and kind of maybe I'd say like refrain from making those big predictions and have a kind of sober understanding about what's going to rebuild a militant minority of class leaders. So we have to ask ourselves as the socialist left what we can do to rebuild social power given these conditions. And following what Emily and Joe have argued, I think that unions are not inherently strategic in one way or another, and that how a union acts depends on the political moment and the balance of class forces. So there's an interesting thing that we agree with the right that unions are inherently political, and but what we want to argue is that what we should be arguing in our workplaces is that we need to challenge the status quo assumption that only by making labor less political and more legalistic will we win support. Because the central issue is about social power, who has it, and whether we can put forward arguments within the labor movement to build it by winning the trust and loyalty of workers. So there are two prongs that I think work together to build a debate about current campaigns that can take away key lessons for organizing or to strengthening labor on the shop floor, as Joe was saying, and building the left. So each of the campaigns that I'll mention has different relationships with the broader left, and while I'm going to make some general points for discussion, I hope that organizers in these campaigns, you know, speak out in the discussion, because I'm not, you know, a part of all of them. So I know that there are a lot of so the political points I'll make are about how the strategy and politics of, for example, public and private sector unions differ. I'll also say something about fighting to win union recognition in unorganized private sectors. Okay, so there's a lot more examples than the ones I'll bring up. In terms of strategy, I think the first thing we should recognize is that workers will be loyal to unions that fight for them. And there's a difference amongst unions in terms of how hard they'll be hit by federal right to work legislation, and not all will face an existential threat. And this is something that Joe mentioned. But the two examples I'm going to talk about that are things that were, you know, written about in left-wing publications and that people have some background in sort of assessing are the CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union, and the CWA, the Communication Workers of America. And so in 2012, the CTU went on strike and landed a major victory in the public sector. And they set the stage for surviving right to work, but also for other public sector teachers, teacher unions to take on strikes and job actions like the Seattle Teachers a few years later, and the CTU again with a day of action in April 2015. Most people probably have some background in assessing the CTU strike, so I'll just say that the consequence of strengthening the union was positioning them in a much more important political role than they had been before. I mean, I remember after the strike, it was like they were on the statewide stage of a battle over pensions. And the newly elected governor was explicitly doing political battle with the CTU. So by winning the trust of their members, the CTU expanded its base in schools and out of schools, leading to deeper discussions of the connection between the education system and social justice issues within the membership. And this wasn't just a case of social justice unionism, as if the CTU had a unique political orientation because of a particular the left-wing membership. It was a product of arguing for the defense of communities and their solidarity as a constitutive element of protecting teachers' jobs and arguing for what those jobs mean to their communities. The political difference between public sector unions and private sector unions is that public sector unions engage in the issues that affect the communities they serve more directly, even if these are issues over which they cannot collectively bargain. This means that the threat to the public sector and struggles here are inherently political, and the organizing strategies in some ways necessarily broader than in other sectors. Public sector workers are fighting for whole communities and the services they need as well as their own interests. Additionally, a strike in the public sector isn't about profit in the way that withholding labor usually is. So when we ask, where is our power? Emily mentioned one of our discussions, you're actually kind of saving the boss money by not going to work if you are striking in the public sector. So when we say, where is our power? You actually are having to talk about leveraging a broader movement in organizing your job action. In the private sector, the CWA went on strike against Verizon last year in 2016. This campaign, as far as I remember, was strongly issue-based around problems of forced workplace mobility, healthcare, and technological changes, and transitioning to wireless services by the company. The picket lines had fronts at work sites and at retail stores to make customers aware of the strike and educate them about it. Pickets were adopted to prevent scabs from getting to job sites and also prevent them to protest them at their hotels, which with support from, I think, unionized hotel employees in some cases in New York City where we were organizing. Large rallies were held with the membership to demonstrate the strength that was also staged during the Bernie campaign. The union hoped that his sympathy to working class demands would transmit to his support base. Following the Verizon strike this year, and this is a really exciting thing that I think a lot of people participated in recently, retail workers at AT&T went on a 3-day strike to flex their membership muscles and test their strength. Workers reported being given confidence by the Verizon victory in 2016, and first-time strikers gained experience and reporting on the picket lines to us fear and excitement because they didn't know if anyone was going to come out for them, and then when the city did, I mean, they did. There were some big picket lines, the ones in Brooklyn and downtown, and we had one uptown. They were excited. It increased their confidence. So in the private sector, however, solidarity needs to be argued for and fought for in a different way, since these fights can be very issue-based. But when it's proven to workers that solidarity is not only morally important, but works as an organizing strategy for the success of job actions, the base of people loyal to the union actions can become more open to broader class demands. And I think that contributes to sort of Joe's third point that labor needs to become an advocate of class demands. This was evident in the increase in confidence during the Verizon strikes when Filipino call center workers performed sympathy work slowdowns. And it became clear that it's not the Filipinos who are taking your jobs. So both of these campaigns are moving into the right to work period with a developing cadre of activists and a workforce of battle-tested union members, and that makes a big difference. But it's worth emphasizing that both unions today face enormous difficulties. A mass series of school closings after the strike in Chicago and a hostile state leadership trying to take away their pensions, and a monster communications company selling parts of its service across the country to continue the transition to being a completely wireless company. They just sold several states, are now this frontier company because Verizon knows that the money is in wireless and breaking the unions is the goal. Given the ongoing aggressions of the employers, we have to see these examples of class struggle as a basis and starting point for discussion of how strategies taken by unions prior to right to work can help us think through what it will take to rebuild and activate membership, but have a sober understanding of where even the strongest examples of class struggle today are in the balance of class forces. We can also assess more recent strategy of these unions. I've heard in other discussions during the conference about the impact on the organizing capacity of the CTU after trying to participate in municipal elections by taking advantage of loopholes for independent politics, making the electoral strategy diverge from the shop floor strategy, and I assume that will be a sort of fault line of debate in a lot of unions. The focus should be on building the strength of rank-and-file union organizers, and we can see the difference in the bottom-up confidence in union politics from this perspective. So other campaigns in the private sector who are fighting for union recognition from the bottom up and, like, from scratch are a lot more uneven, like Fight for 15 and graduate worker unions. Within these campaigns, we can see a degree of more or less success depending on whether the emphasis of the campaign is about shop floor conversations and democratic union reform that wins the trust of its base. The debate about the SEIU-led Fight for 15 campaign since the fast food walkouts in 2012 has raised a lot of dimensions of critique and debate that shows the unevenness of the movement. I think that one criticism of SEIU's strategy is that the fight for union recognition has often focused on a strategy of quick mobilizations and confrontations with management that don't represent the power of an organized base. And I think they've replicated this, and this is sort of anecdotal, I guess, in some of their adjunct organizing works of part-time workers at universities. They'll sort of have petitions and then like go confront, for example, the university president really quickly, and it's not a real display of power, and the president, for example, will just ignore them. So, and with no consequence. So mobilizations can't be a substitute for the deep organizing focused on face-to-face discussion to win over unconvinced, perhaps because fearful, workers. However, it's important to appreciate and understand that is to the credit of the Fight for 15 campaign that it has brought low-wage work into the national spotlight and shifted the conversation about the nature of this workforce in a significant way. I think this is also true for retail workers. And also its loose nature, within SEIU has also allowed it to form relationships with social movements against oppression that are broader than itself, particularly during the height of Black Lives Matter in major cities. I remember there being a discussion about the Black Youth Project endorsing Fight for 15 during that period. And so this deepened union activist discussion about anti-racist organizing and low-wage work. This represents a crack in neoliberal discipline, but the successes have come without the protection of union contracts, and I think we should be clear that we want contracts. Without them, they're much more vulnerable to resistance of implementation, wage theft, and all of the issues that happen when you don't have a union. Grad unions are a different animal in the private sector. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this because that's where I'm organizing, but not too much. These are fights for union recognition when there is a precedent set for unionization of the same workforce in the public sector. Between 2004 and 2015, graduate students did not have a right to collective bargaining because their legal status was as students and not employees. When the Obama NLRB overruled the 2004 decision in a court case won by the UAW, representatives of graduate student workers at Columbia University, a whole host of campaigns kicked off all over the country because the law was on our side. We expect this to change with the Trump board decision as soon as it comes up, since universities are trying to tie these cases up as much as possible in court to prevent unionization, because they know also that that's probably an inevitable outcome of the Trump board. But it is important to see that during this period, there has only been one contract negotiated with a major private university, and it was negotiated at NYU in, I think, 2014, prior to the NLRB ruling. The Columbia students who won the legal battle are still working without a contract, and other universities where union elections have been held and won are in a similar legal position. A big difference is that the focus of the NYU union on democratic reform within the UAW's reform caucus, ADU, focused on one-on-one conversations in every department. They challenged the UAW leadership's bargaining strategy, and they forced them to open the bargaining table to the bargaining unit, requiring their leadership's presence at every session. The deepening of democracy within the union activated the base and resulted in a 98% vote approving a strike if necessary to get NYU to settle. At the last minute, NYU caved after a campaign for public support with the undergrads on the part of graduate workers. And I think if we can take one lesson from this example is that the recognition game isn't up when the Trump board sings, because the legal strategy isn't enough to win recognition if the base isn't activated to make the institution cave. So the most fundamental way to move forward with uneven movements like these is through issue-based organizing that re-wins the argument for collective action on the shop floor, which means that unions need to reestablish a presence, like what Joe was saying, at the level of each individual workplace. It also means conscientious membership drives that focus on training leadership and people to be shop stewards. And the reason that issue-based organizing is important is that it activates the membership who's not already won to supporting the union. This means having political face-to-face conversations that are aimed towards smart job actions. Unions need to demonstrate the value of being a union member, and this way labor can prove that it is social power that matters and win over a militant layer of activists who are tested labor organizers that can provide leadership. I think that the political questions about grad unions are different than these other workforces and worth bringing up specifically in terms of its relevance to the labor movement and left as a whole. I think that socialists hesitate to develop an organizing focus on grad unions because of their relative lack of social power compared to other labor sectors, and also because of ideological skepticism of academia, especially since these are graduate students and not radicalizing undergrads. It's a workforce less likely to radicalize because the stakes of changing your ideological orientation once you've made it far enough along are quite high. On the other hand, there is a big debate on the left about the importance of campus work, movement work, and why universities are or are not a battleground for the left, particularly today in fighting the right over free speech and in the far right's attempt to recruit on campus. It's also worth noting that socialist cadre are behind these union campaigns, making them a project on the periphery of other movement work and organization building that they're already doing. My position is that it's important to not overestimate the importance of grad unions, but they should be understood as an important part of building the infrastructure of the left and the long-term vision of the labor movement. So first, the links to the other parts of the labor movement are undetermined, but we should expect grad unions to make unique contributions to social justice union work, fighting for gender-neutral bathrooms in the workplace in support of trans rights, and passing BDS resolutions are already some things that grad union locals have accomplished. California grads are also arguing to have their union dissociate itself from police unions. Okay, I'm almost done. In terms of campus movement work, there are many possibilities for solidarity between campus movement work and grad union organizing. But a big picture point is that having labor struggles on campuses gives a whole generation of campus activists exposure to the organized left and a strategy for building social power that most have not experienced. Fighting for union democracy and being willing to collaborate with other groups as needed to solicit solidarity in workplace actions sets an important precedent for movement work on campuses that I think is desperately needed. Having these campaigns spearheaded by revolutionary socialists is sort of, you know, icing on the cake. Further, a culture of strikes among students and grad workers reshapes the terrain on which campus contracts are negotiated. The administration will remember when a host of students went on strike, and so will the students. So we can look to Montreal student strike organizing for examples of this. They are much more resistant to imposing neoliberal reforms there. So, grad union organizing experience is also important to train new members of the organized left. This is no longer going, they're no longer going into middle class jobs. Some will, a few will, but a lot of them are entering the youth workforce and other sectors. This is the changing shape of education, higher education. Further, graduate unions have a large role to play in protecting free speech and fighting the normalization of the far right on campus. The consequence of transitioning to a part-time workforce in academia is squeezing out tenure. Tenure is not just an issue of job security for the ivory tower. Tenure is a political issue because without it, faculty lose the basic right to free speech and publication, and I think so do their students. Consequently, the restriction on free speech sets the precedent in and out of the classroom that universities are not a place for movement work and free inquiry. That ideological opening, that contradictory space that universities have always represented for the left, that closes more. Campus activism also makes fighters of the future off campus. My last point is that it's also demobilizing for radicalizing campus movement work, because what happens when you have a faculty that's afraid of losing their jobs and they don't have a union and they don't have tenure is that you have a demonstration on your campus, there are disciplinary procedures enacted against you, and you are terrified to do any of that because you don't think that your faculty will sign a petition to support you. And that is huge to create pressure on the administration on these campuses. Okay, so I think those are the rest of my thoughts, and I hope that opened up some issues for discussion.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.